coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borak Thung, Earthlits, and welcome to the 2000 AD Thrillcast. I am your host, Malt Char, and we've got another fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes action on the galaxy's greatest comic as we hurtle through the cosmos towards Prog 2000 at the end of September. We're going to be talking to Tom Eglinton about his ongoing series Outlier, which is fast reaching its conclusion within our pages. Some great artwork by Carl Richardson every week in that, and it's the sort of high concept sci-fi stuff for those of you who haven't been reading it. We're also going to be talking to not only the creator of 2000 AD, not only its first editor, but also the man behind so much of the history of 1970s, 1980s British comics, and that's Mr. Pat Mills. We're going to be talking to him about Misty, the girls' horror comic that was launched way back when, which we have just collected together two stories from in the Misty collection, and that is The Four Faces of Eve and Moonchild, which are absolutely engrossing stories that take horror themes and put certain twists from the time on, but all geared towards a young female audience, which makes them absolutely fascinating. And it's a great read. And we're going to be talking to Pat about Misty and why that came about. Nicely complimenting the chat we had with Ian Rimmer a few weeks ago about Scream, which was the other horror comic from which we are, which we have just reprinted Monster by Alan Moore, John Wagner, Alan Grant, Heinzel, and Jesus Redondo. That is already available. Misty will be available on the 8th of September from all good bookstores and online from our webshop and apps. Talking about things that are coming up on the 1st of September, if you are in or around London, then I heartily recommend that you come along to Orbital Comics at around about 7:30 in the evening for a great event. It's the launch of The Mighty One, which is the Steve McManus memoir about 2000 AD and British comics in the 1970s and 80s and his work beyond. Steve is going to be doing a talk as well as a signing. There'll be a few drinks, an opportunity to meet the man himself. Those of you who listened to our interview with him just recently will know what a fantastic storyteller he is. And it's a really keen insight into this kind of critical period of 2000 AD and its golden age in the 1980s. So make sure you come along to Orbital Comics on the evening of the 1st of September, where you'll get to hear him in person. We've also got some exciting news coming up about Prog 2000 and what's happening around that, so please do keep your aural sensors tuned for more information. So let's crack on with this episode of the Thrillcast by talking to Tom Eglinton about Outlier, which is currently hurtling towards its conclusion in the pages of the galaxy's greatest comic. So, Tom, welcome back to the Thrillcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me back.
So, we're on to a new series of Outlier at the moment, Survivor Guilt. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the concept behind Outlier?
The whole concept or just this series?
The whole concept. Let's go back to the beginning.
Okay, so the beginning really just started with a very sort of simple kind of revenge story, I suppose, which was CASA, private detectives, kind of hired to investigate these murders, and he soon discovers that the man behind them, a man called Call, is being used by this alien race called the Herd, who are sort of technologically advanced, enigmatic kind of alien race, I suppose you'd say. And Call's gone on this sort of revenge spree after his crewmates on a scavenger ship left him for dead, and he's been sort of resurrected in this suit that kind of prints out tissue. So he's kind of like a strange facsimile of himself.
Right.
So that was the kind of first series, and it deals with this kind of idea of a strange alien race that you kind of are remaining one step ahead of humanity at every stage. With the second series, it kind of moves into Cole and Cass are working together to try and free Cass's parents and Cole's partner Jess from an ark ship that the herd have, where they keep human specimens. And so the second series sort of dealing more with learning a bit more about the herd and the humans trying to sort of fight back a bit and save themselves. And then this third series is kind of things moving towards all-out war with the herd.
Mm.
So that's sort of where we find ourselves at the beginning of series three.
Okay. No, I mean, you mentioned that it's a classic revenge tale, but with, you know, in a very kind of hyper sci-fi future kind of thing. What are some of the ideas and themes you've wanted to explore with Outlier? What was the kind of the motivating thing behind the series?
Well, I think with each series, I've tried to sort of do something a little bit different, sort of thematically, sort of in my own head. The first series was sort of dealing with kind of revenge, but it was really to do with the kind of how self-interest is kind of basically massively flawed. So you have everyone, all the sort of major characters are acting out of self-interest, and that kind of leads to sort of disaster. Everyone ends up, sort of horribly killed or having these horrible consequences from their actions. So that was sort of the idea of what I could use, you know, the revenge template for. Then the second series was, again, about, I guess you'd say, it was about making really bad decisions. I mean, terrible decisions. But it was all to do with really both Carter, who's quite a good man, deciding to sort of do these terrible things to save his parents, to what he, you know, sees as a good thing ultimately.
Mm.
But on the road to that, you end up sort of, you know, creating untold misery and destruction. And then in this third series, this is partly to do with the fallout from the previous two. And also I've got this new character called sort of General Sornell, who is a kind of, I guess you'd say, another flawed ego, who's a kind of power mad, very aggressive, sort of, you know, wildly dangerous man in charge, who sort of leads everyone, you know, to what could be a really sort of disastrous situation. So again, sort of dealing just with flawed egos, I suppose, would be the bottom line.
And I mean, in terms of Carter as a character, I suppose sometimes when you've got kind of high concept sci-fi, sometimes characters can be subsumed by what they are, by their hook. Tell us a little bit about Carter as a character.
As a character, he's I guess he's probably the most decent out of anyone in the story.
Mm.
You know, right from the beginning, he's the one that sort of, and he's very measured, and he's very sort of careful about this. Sort of, you can see that the situation he's getting pulled into is dangerous, and he's the only one that doesn't act out of self-interest. That sort of changes in the second series, but in the first series, he's basically like the sort of good guy, really trying to sort of stop everyone from pushing things forward to a bad resolution, which he can sort of see and sort of sense. So yeah, he's kind of like the good guy that essentially turns bad in the second series. You sort of see him being turned into one of the herd. So he's sort of fighting this internal battle as he gradually changes. And then in this third series, we sort of see him really as a member of the kind of the enemy, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sort of turned.
and with, because you co-created Outlier with Carl Richardson, how much is his artwork part of the driving force of the strip?
Oh, hugely, yeah. And it's sort of interesting because the story kind of changes the more you kind of worked with an artist, because you kind of sort of get a more sense of things that they create as well and how they create them, and where their strengths lie. And so, yeah, certainly with Outlier, it's kind of changed with the second and third series, sort of with what Carl sort of brings to the table, which is loads of great stuff. I mean, it's an amazing amount when you think about the kind of designing technology, designing characters, big action sequences, and each series has kind of gone up in scale. So, you know, the first series was quite sort of small scale. Second series we had much bigger sort of action sequences, and then this third series is sort of, you know, a huge war, so which I'm sure he's pleased with me for. So we're gonna do a massive war, yeah, is that cool? But yeah, no, it's great. He does some just amazing stuff, so it's been fantastic.
And I mean, 2000 AD is known for its kind of space sagas. You know, it's a high octane character led high concept space series. Where do you think Outlier sits in the kind of oeuvre of 2000 AD?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's sort of you know, I'm trying to kind of bring some of them. A kind of a mixture between the sort of old school AD stories with some of the newer stuff. I mean, having Call as a kind of essentially kind of like a 3D printer was kind of fun, but it was an interest that, you know, it was sort of bringing something new to the table, maybe with like having a character could sort of regenerate and, you know, and using some of the technology that we're sort of seeing maybe going to develop and using those ideas. So it's kind of, what would I say? You know, it's kind of like a dark nihilistic sci-fi, but with, you know, done in a fun way. I guess that's it.
And I mean, you've had three series now. Are we coming to the end of the story of Outlier, or have you and Carl sort of thought ahead?
Yes, no, this is the third and final series.
Right, okay. And how do you feel about that as having created this and sort of seen it through to its conclusion? Have things developed as you thought they would, or have sort of surprising developments kind of popped up without you pushing them?
Yeah, I guess it's sort of, yeah, well, it's nice actually to get to the end. I mean, it's also really nice to do three series, because really when you do a first series of anything, and you know, having not done any series before this,
yeah,
you're really unknown quantity. So with the first series, really didn't know whether we'd get a second series, and then with the second series, we didn't know if we'd get a third series. So it's been sort of kind of interesting and really nice actually as well to see it sort of develop and grow and kind of also, you know, kind of create this world that we can, me and Carl can sort of play around in. So that part has been great. But yeah, it's sort of, and as far as things that have turned up, I mean, it seems to have gone the route that I kind of expected. Yeah, you do have things that kind of sort of change. So yeah, I mean, originally, you know, some of the stuff that I conceived of was maybe a bit too weird. So I sort of contained some of that. It's worked really well.
And were there any elements that you really wanted to bring into the series but just couldn't find a right fit for them?
Yeah, I guess there was stuff to do with the herd that I actually really wanted to kind of do, but I just really didn't have the space to kind of explore the idea of a sort of superior race and how you might perceive them, which is quite a difficult thing to do. But so I didn't really have time for that. And also there was aspects that I wanted to do of some of the characters like Call, when he's sort of in the herd sort of culture, and sort of some of that, I kind of really would have loved to played around with that, you know, sort of some very sort of weird kind of sci-fi stuff. But I don't know if it'd really work, to be honest. You realize that once you start writing something, it's kind of, you become defined, you know, by your characters. So you can have all these sort of wacky ideas, but really it's kind of tied down to the sort of character and how they sort of develop. So,
right.
So yeah, so it's all been good.
Okay. And have you as a writer developed over the time of Outlier? Do you feel the process of writing a series like this, where you know you had to a certain extent the uncertainty of whether there was going to be a new series? Do you think that has changed you, improved you as a writer?
Oh yeah, definitely, yeah. I mean, it's killer, some of the the 2000 AD format. You know, it is really difficult, but the great thing of that is it really sort of enforces kind of craft, because you're doing 5 pages an episode where you have to have, you know, a mini sort of story arc within that, and then you have to, you know, over 50 pages do this kind of bigger story. It seems really easy when I look at other, you know, writers' work in AD, the stuff that looks effortless, you know, they've put loads of work into it.
Yeah.
But because it is a real sort of skill. And so I've been learning that partly as well, which, yeah, it's definitely, Outlier's been great for that.
Okay. Because you've got Blunt running in the magazine at the moment with Boo Cook.
That's right,
go on, sorry.
We've reached the psychedelic episode.
Every strip needs a psychedelic episode.
Every strip needs a psychedelic episode, yeah. Right.
So you've got that running. Have you got anything else in the pipeline for 2080?
Yeah, I've got a couple of dreads sort of in production. One of them with Boot, actually.
Right.
That's a two-parter, which I'm not sure when that'll be out. And then I'm doing another dread at the moment I'm writing. And I've got a few things in the pipeline that I want to sort of develop, but that's just a case of as and when. Because I'm just sort of, you know, looking forward to what to do next, really.
Yeah.
And which direction to go in.
Now, any of you who've been listening to the Thrillcast over the past few months will undoubtedly have enjoyed the interviews with people like Chris Lauder, Steve McManus and Ian Rimmer, where we've been talking about the heyday of British comics in the 1970s and 80s, when it was not unheard of for titles to be selling 250,000 copies every single week. One of those titles that was only around for a short while but had a lot of impact was Misty, which was, a horror comic for girls, I guess, if you want to be reductive. Then it was much more kind of girl-focused. It was a slightly different style of making comics, but it was specifically horror focused. Now, we're going to be bringing out, as I mentioned, a collection of two of the Misty strips, Moonchild and The Four Faces of Eve, at the beginning of September. And it was absolutely fantastic to welcome Pat Mills back onto the 2080 Thrillcast as one of the, the guy behind Misty, who gave it its ethos and brought it into the world. So, it was fascinating to learn a little bit more about girls' comics in the heyday of the British industry and, what went on behind the scenes. Well, welcome back to the 2080 Thrillcast, Pat.
Great to be on it. Cheers, Michael.
No worries. So we're here to talk about Misty, which is coming out next month. Two of the stories from Misty, The Four Faces of Eve and Moonchild. Let's talk a little bit about what Misty was for the uninitiated. It was essentially a horror comic for girls.
That's one way of describing it. I mean, I think when one uses the word horror, it can perhaps sound like an EC horror comic. And I always describe horror as, you know, it runs the spectrum from, say, EC comics or even, you know, kind of quite colourful sort of things like, you know, Dracula and vampires and so on, to Stephen King. Mm. Now, I saw Misty as a kind of diluted Stephen King because, you know, the Stephen King thing, sort of story, but without any kind of adult elements. So, yes. I mean, the film that really, I think, inspired Misty was Carrie, because Carrie, you know, is a classic girl's story. I mean, it's it works on every level, and it's very, very compelling. So that, if you like, was my kind of role model for the comic, and specifically for Moonchild, which became the lead story in Misty.
Mm. Now, the world of comics was very different back in the 70s and 80s. I mean, we've had Chris Lauder on, we've had Ian Rimmer, we've had Steve McManus, and they've all talked about how the landscape of the industry was very, very different. At the time, how did you go about pitching a comic like this? Because the girls' comics at the time, in some cases, outsold comics for boys, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the whole sort of legacy of comics, you know, leading up to 2000 AD, it all dates back to Tammy originally, because Tammy, its sales at one point were 250,000 copies a week. Wow. And that compares with 2000 AD's launch sales, which were 200,000 copies a week, which was obviously seen as a huge success. The girls' comics were really the foundation of it all. And the fact that they've disappeared subsequently is down to nothing other than what you might call internal office politics, or to put it another way, no one cared about them enough. But it's no reflection on the readers whatsoever. The interest in girls' comics was always there. And essentially, everything just got screwed up because the emphasis was more on male comics, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So that, if you like, was the background. And my job was to create new comics. So there was battle, there was action, it was 2000 AD. And so, I mean, I was already thinking about, okay, so what's my next project going to be? Now, the reason for that would be simply that I was freelance. Now, anyone who is actually going to stay on the comic, in effect, becomes a staffer. You know, in other words, they're, you know, they become part of everything. And the way I was producing these comics really was to set a kind of standard and give them a certain level of quality, which would be very difficult to sustain in the environment at the time, because the environment was well, there's several words you could use to describe it, but I'll use a polite one, and I'll say it was complacent. And you know, I really wasn't prepared to compromise in what I was doing. So, having made sure that 2000 AD was a success, I think it was round about issue 12 that I intended to go back to freelancing, and my next project was going to be Misty. And I'd already talked over we had the title. I'd had a preliminary conversation with John Sanders, the publisher, about it. And unfortunately, we couldn't agree on financial terms. And that's why, in effect, I kind of ended up having sort of started it, if you like, a kind of consulting editor or a consulting kind of, if you like, I kind of co-created it with the first editor of Misty, which was Wolf Pridmore. Mm. So that's the background.
Okay. Now, you've talked before about your intention of making Misty effectively an equivalent of 2000 AD, but for the female audience.
Yeah.
What were the sort of balances and compromises that you needed to make in order to make that happen?
Well, funnily enough, I think if I'd been on it full time, I think there would have been very few compromises. I mean, even as it stands, I mean, the first principle was to say, okay, with 2000 AD, something quite revolutionary had happened where the artwork was really standing out and stunning. Now, there's always been great artwork in British comics, but if you have a three-page story with, like, whatever it is, say, nine pictures on a page or something like that, you know, you're not really doing the artist or the readers any favors. So 2000 AD had this wonderful imagery, these wonderful scenes. And so I wanted the same thing to happen on Misty. And I think artwork-wise, layout-wise, for a number of reasons, it probably wasn't as potent as 2000 AD. But that said, a lot of the artists on Misty and original Misty readers, I'm sure, will agree with me on this, were often of a higher standard than the artists on 2000 AD, especially in the early days. I mean, we had absolutely fantastic artists on Misty. And they all, to some extent, came from a similar sources, from either Argentina or Spain or Italy. But I think it's fair to say that the female artists, or the artists who were drawing girls' comics anyway, were generally better than the Spanish or Italian or Argentinian artists who were working on 2000 AD. I mean, they were all good, but the Misty artists had the edge, and that's why you'll see some really stunning artwork in Misty. Mm.
Why do you think that is?
I think maybe there was a long tradition of great girls' comic art. There was a very long tradition of it, and perhaps there were more publications producing it. But I think the other thing was, you know, that with some of the male artists, their layouts were stodgy. They were boring. Ah, yeah. And of course, this is the other thing, and it's coming back to me now. What was at stake? On 2000 AD, I was asking people to create science fiction worlds. And often this was actually beyond the abilities of European artists. They weren't used to this kind of thing. They weren't from France. France, of course, is the epitome of that. You know, you've got all these great artists who inspired films like Blade Runner and so on. But elsewhere, if you were saying, right, well, we want this fantastic city, you know, we want this fantastic spaceship and so on, often that wasn't on the cards. Notable exceptions, of course, being Carlos Esquerra and Ballardinelli. But elsewhere, we were getting pretty stodgy stuff. Now, on the girls' comic side, all the artist has to do, I say all, still a big all, he's just got to create characters, because fantasy worlds or hardware is not the primary requirement for a girls comic, whether it's fantasy, horror, or you know, girls' boarding school story. I mean, you want a good atmosphere, but it's not that there's not so much at stake. And of course, that's why later on 2000 AD, a lot of the European artists were replaced by British fan-orientated artists who knew exactly what to do. You know, guys like Kevin O'Neill, Brian Bolland, and Dave Gibbons, and so forth. So, you know, that, if you like, I think it was the background. But interestingly, and I think I think it was, well, it was definitely the right choice. On Misty, the two stories you guys have chosen to reprint, Moonchild and Four Faces of Eve, they are actually by British artists. And I think that British sensibility gives those two particular stories a special edge. If they perhaps had been drawn by a European artist, there may have been just a slight gap in terms of its appeal to an audience.
Okay. Now, at the time, there were a lot of women working in comics, both artists and writers. But Misty had more men working on it than women. Was there a particular reason for that?
The whole thing was girls' comics were mainly, there were notable exceptions, but they were mainly written and edited by guys. Right. And the reason was because female magazine journalists wanted to work on the glossies and they weren't comfortable. They didn't want to work on something like, say, Tammy, which was edited by Jerry Finley Day. Sandy, which was edited by John Wagner, and so forth. The notable exception being Mavis Miller, editor of Jinty, who was a different generation, if you like, to everybody else. And she actually was responsible for some great science fiction stories in Jinty. So the thing was, there was a gap there that women weren't actually that interested. And that's something we should also bear in mind. That isn't necessarily, oh, well, that was in the bad old days. Things are different now. You know, that's the way everyone always likes to present things. Not so, I'm afraid, because in the past, when I was trying to get Misty revived, at one point it was optioned by another publisher. And he showed it around his editorial team, and every one of them said they didn't want to be involved, including female editors. And that's only a few years ago. You know, what are we talking? Maybe 8 years ago, something like that. Mm-hmm. There is something there that is not properly acknowledged. I stress this. We're talking about mainstream comics here. We're not talking about, there's any number of female writers and editors, in the, what you might call the sort of vertigo end of things. But what we're talking about are stories that are aimed at, the girl in the street, the woman in the street. They don't have to be aficionados. And that's always the market that's always appealed to me. I'll come clean. You probably already know this. I despise elitism in comics. I despise it in any form. And that's the great thing about Misty. It's not elitist. And I think it can give elitist comics a damn good run for its money.
Let's talk about Shirley Bellwood for a moment, who did so many memorable covers for Misty. How important was it to have an artist of that kind of quality producing covers, because they're wonderfully painted, evocative covers on those issues?
Yeah, I think Shirley, and I think there was another artist as well, really were absolute artistic geniuses, and I think they have a long history in comics, and I think the appeal on Misty, it gave the comic a strong identity and so on. Now, that said, and I have gone on record as saying this, actually, I think if I had actually been the full-on editor, I don't think Misty would have gone down that particular road.
All right. Okay.
This sounds... I don't know, it sounds a little curmudgeonly perhaps, but the reason I say that is because it's actually to do with getting feedback from the readers. Now, all of us now, as adults, you know, all the people who are going to probably buy the book, you know, a lot of them will be adults, and they say, oh, but these covers are beautiful. But what I based that view on was the feedback that I was getting at the time, not specifically on Misty covers, but generally that readers, male and female, were reacting against anything that was ethereal and romantic. Now, of course, Shirley Bellwood's artwork is wonderfully ethereal, it's wonderfully romantic, but the mood, the tone at that time was quite ballsy. It was quite kitchen sink, it wasn't North London. It was down market, and I think we should be proud of that. Do you know what I mean? That's not a negative. And it was frustrating for me at first because, hey, I like ethereal, romantic artwork and stories as much as anybody. And to my great disappointment, I would find that most of the time it just wouldn't register with the readers. Now, okay, I'm sure lots of Misty readers will write in and say, yeah, but it worked for me. Yeah, she made it work, but there was that reservation. And perhaps it's a great thing. Shirley, I think, probably was the exception to the rule, but I think it is worth mentioning that rule that certainly at the time, and I still suspect it's probably a little bit that way now, there was this, I don't know, for want of another word, you could say down-to-earth quality, Grange Hill quality, and that could apply to horror just as much as it could apply to a boarding school story or anything else. You know, not trying to be too away with the fairies, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of the collection that we've got coming out next month, I mean, we've already mentioned that we've got Four Faces of Eve and Moonchild. To somebody who hasn't read any of these girls' comics of the 70s and 80s, what would you say to them to encourage them to pick it up?
Okay. Well, in the case of Moonchild, it's drawn by John Armstrong. Now, anyone who has a background in, obviously, you know, in male comics, you know, names like Brian Bolland or Dave Gibbons and so on are obviously going to register with them. John Armstrong was the Brian Bolland of girls' comics. His stories were phenomenally popular. So, I mean, he was known before Moonchild for the hugely successful series Bella, which was about a gymnast based on Olga Corbett and Nadia Comaneci and so forth. But, of course, a very down-to-earth British gymnast. And so the reason he was so successful was because he could show a range of facial expressions on his heroines, or indeed on everybody, that was almost supernatural. Now, if you look at a lot of male comic artists, and male comics in general, they may have a range of emotions ranging from, you know, sort of angry to irritated to mildly pissed off. In other words, say they've got three faces to convey those different that spectrum of emotions. John Armstrong, by comparison, would have 20. So you are looking at a TV almost, you know what I mean? In other words, he really captures that whole range of things. And it was because he had female models, and he really studied, you know, how to achieve that end result. And the other thing, of course, is he's inking. His black and white style is very, very appealing as well. So, you know, his artwork jumps off the page. So that's one reason. On the story side, of course, Moonchild is heavily influenced by Carrie, which I think has been remade, or they're remaking it or something. I mean, it's a classic film. It's the plot of Carrie is just, you know, it just reaches everybody. So that's one reason. And then we come to Four Faces of Eve, which was drawn by Brian Delaney and written by Malcolm Shaw. Now, Brian Delaney was the sort of top girls comic artist in Scotland, I think. In fact, when I first got into working on girls comics, I seem to remember editing one of his stories. And, you know, there's a clarity. He's a great, great storyteller. And his artworks appeared in, you know, magazines like, I think, Jackie. I think they were very, very fond of his artwork on Jackie, because he really knows how to tell the story. And then we come to the story by Malcolm Shaw, and it's a very dark, dark story, and it's beautifully, sensitively told by Malcolm. And I remember when I read it in Misty thinking, yeah, wow, I wish I'd come up with that. Mm-hmm. I was envious of it, because it's such a clever and dark story. And the other thing that's very important about it as well is, well, both stories is they have strong protagonists. Now, those are the kind of stories that appeal to readers the most at the time, and I think would appeal for exactly the same reason today, because they have strong protagonists. And Malcolm did some other great stories for Misty, one of which I know some Misty readers will say, hey, why didn't you do The Sentinels? And I think that's a strong possibility for a second round. The Sentinels is about a kind of alternative girl moving between a modern day tower block environment to a kind of Nazi Britain kind of alternative dimension. Now, the thing with stories like that is they're great stories, but they're what you might call situation stories. And and the whole thing with girls' comics generally is if it's a character story, it will generally have the edge over a situation story. And that possibly goes for boys' comics as well. I mean, these are the things you discover the hard way. You know, you think, wow, this story is really going to go down a storm. And then you think, why didn't that work? And that, you know, so afterwards, when you get the reader feedback and you start analyzing, you think, aha, so that's why. Mm-hmm. So two stories that, you know, they were chosen with considerable care, I think, to be the premier Best of Misty. Mm-hmm. and not just by all of us, you know, on Rebellion and so on, but also checking with original Misty readers. You know, what would you like to see reprinted? Do you think these are the best stories?
And what does it mean for you as you know, the person who worked on this and brought it helped bring it to life, to see it reprinted now?
slight exhaustion, because I think I've been banging on about, you've got to do some girls' comic reprints. You've got to do some girls' comic reprints. And I've been going on and on like this to endless editors and publishers, probably for about the best part of 10 years. And so there's obviously I'm delighted and satisfied that it's finally happened. But it was actually almost a feeling of fear to think, Christ, these things are never going to see the light of day again. And manga, fantastic as it is, and it's obviously filled that gap for a female readership, at the end of the day, it's still from another country. Mm. And, you know, we produce these girls' comics. They sold in huge numbers. And we're not talking about, 100 years ago or anything. And a classic story is a classic story. Harry Potter's set in, a boarding school that seems out of the 1950s or something. So, you know, a good story is a good story. And I'm just aware of how many other wonderful stories there are in the vaults that really do need to see the light of day. So there's a lot resting on this. So I'm slightly nervous as well as exhausted, thinking, God, everybody's put a lot of effort into making this happen. So there's a lot riding on this for all of us, I think, because if for whatever reason it doesn't work, I don't want to be thinking, oh, God, it's going to be another 10 years before anyone else, you know, really opens this treasure chest.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's a collection that a lot of people, including yourself, probably thought they'd never see. But it's great to be able to bring, you know, these gems back into circulation.
You've obviously... you're a younger generation and so on. So you're looking at this. How does it come across to you, seeing these stories? Is it like from another planet or what?
It's really interesting because the production values are so very different to 2000 AD at the time. And the feel of it, because, you know, just the lettering alone is very differently presented. The one thing that really struck me was how the writing really comes through. Like sometimes, you know, particularly in the first few years of 2000 AD, you get a spread of, I don't know, Dan Dare by Massimo. And it's just, you know, you're so busy feasting on the visual that's in front of you that the you don't necessarily get the full impact of the story. Whereas with the Misty stuff, it really felt still fresh.
That's interesting to know. And I think you've actually made a very good point there. It probably ties in with that kind of... it's like a cousin of Vertigo in a way, because on Vertigo there is undoubtedly for certainly a lot of the classic strips a strong emphasis on the writing and the storytelling rather than necessarily big visual dramatic images that are so associated with 2000 AD. And yeah, that said, I remember, I think it was the first time we'd ever done this on a girl's comic, where you'll see in the pages of Moonchild in particular, large images, scary images of Moonchild herself as a kind of Mia Farrow. I mean, she was, you know, the artist was using Mia Farrow as a kind of role model for what she should look like. And you seeing these big scary faces was a new departure. But that said, that aside, the emphasis was, you know, they were very writer driven, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I think one thing that did really strike me was that particularly 2000 AD at the time, and things like the Revived Eagle and whatnot, boys' comics tended to be high concept.
Yes.
So you'd have these big grand space operas, these big sort of SF and fantasy ideas. Whereas the girls' comics, and this is probably undoubtedly as a result of, the tradition they were coming from, were much more personal stories.
Yeah, and this is also because, to a large extent, that's generally what the readers were looking for. So what it meant actually from a writer's point of view is that you could put all your mental energy into the emotional nuances, the conflict, the plot, and so on. And you wouldn't have to be thinking to yourself, as all too often you would be on Judge Dredd or ABC Warriors or something. What's his gun look like? what's his motorbike? Or, you know, what kind of car is he driving? These kind of things, for the most part, a female readership is less interested. Now, there is a downside to that, and I actually tested a number of stories out on my nieces, who range in age from I think 14 to 17, and they liked Moonchild. They liked Four Faces of Eve, which was a huge relief. But when I showed them some other stories, they were going, the fashions are wrong on her. Don't like the fashions. I said, yeah, come on, it's the 70s, and they're saying, yeah, but it's still still bad. They're still not good, you know. And you actually do find that in some female genre fiction. I think it's that Blue Blood, a vampire thing, you know. There's a strong emphasis on what shoes and things like that, which, you know, for the most part, you wouldn't have a male secret agent story where you're going on about, you know, he's wearing an Aquascutum leather coat or something, you know. So there's always detail somewhere. It's just I think it's easier on the female side, you know, just have to have the right magazines around you for inspiration.
As always, make sure that you are keeping up to date on the latest 2000 AD news by subscribing to the Thrill Mail. If you go to 2000adonline.com/thrillmail, then you can sign up. You get a weekly thrillgasm into your inbox with all the latest information. There's also links in there to things like the 2000 AD ABC on our YouTube channel, where we have just hit Chopper. For those of you who are big fans of the wall scroller turned teenage rebel turned sky surf champion, and loads of other goodies, including weekly competitions. So make sure you keep up to date with that. I want to thank Pat and Tom for talking to us on this episode of the Thrillcast, and I want to thank you, wherever you are, for tuning in to our podcast. It's great to see the numbers grow ever greater as people spread the word about our official podcast. Please make sure you give us a rating on iTunes if you listen to us on there, and a share on your social media so that other people can bask in the glow of Tharg's thrill power. Splundig Verthrig, Earthlets. Now, are you reading the galaxy's greatest comic? 2000 AD is in orbit every Wednesday from all good news agents and comic book stores. 2000 AD is also available digitally. You can get PDF copies, which are DRM-free, from our website at www.2000adonline.com, or you can download the free 2000 AD app for Apple and Android devices. Now, you get that by searching for 2000 space AD in iTunes and the Google Play Store. There's also the Judge Dredd magazine, which is published in print and digital every month with more pages, more Dredd-centric stories, special features, and a bagged reprint magazine featuring forgotten 2000 AD classics. And don't forget that our graphic novels, including absolute timeless classics like Strontium Dog, Ace Trucking, Flesh, Judge Dredd, Slain, Robo Hunter, and many, many more, are also available digitally through our webshop and app. We're on social media with the latest announcements, competitions and freebies. Search on Facebook and Google Plus for 2000 AD. If you're on Instagram, we're Insta2000AD, and you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at 2000AD. In the meantime, all hail Tharg the Mighty and Splundig Verthrig, Earthlets.